Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about a chapter of World War II that's perhaps less well explored than, you know, more mainstream things such as D-Day or the Battle of Midway or what have you. And one of the reasons why it's less well explored is because it doesn't fit with the overall narrative of the Second World War. In fact, it's creates all sorts of confusing and complex problems for us to try to unravel, which is why it's really worth addressing. And the thing I want to talk about is Churchill's relationship with Greece, or almost his kind of obsession with Greece during the war. Now, it's well known that Allied tensions between Britain and the United States were strained considerably over Churchill's passion for a Mediterranean strategy. Churchill and the British chiefs of staff, particularly Sir Alan Brooke, believed that the American desire for an early cross-channel invasion was doomed to failure, and that a kind of peripheral strategy, an idea of squeezing the Third Reich at the margins and in its sort of in the kind of the periphery of Hitler's empire, was far more likely to succeed. And there seems to be a lot in this. The Casablanca Conference was it was the last moment really where the British got their own way, where the Americans believed that they had to bow to the superior knowledge and expertise and experience of the British. The subsequent failings and false dawns and general sort of missed opportunities that the British have in Italy, not entirely of their own making. Certainly, General Mark Clark's refusal to obey the orders of General Alexander, British General Alexander, at Anzio, and to race forth and capture Rome instead of cutting off the Germans in the Alban Hills. This doesn't help matters, but by the end of 1944, the Americans have really little truck with the idea that they can be told what to do by the British any longer. And also the economic and financial relationship between America and Britain has changed to such an extent that really Britain is almost completely reliant on American largesse, which means that an awful lot of influence can be brought to bear. Churchill, when he met Stalin at the Yalta Conference, agrees with Stalin various spheres of influence. This is recorded in the so-called Naughty Letter, or the Naughty Note or Memorandum, where certain percentages of influence were granted to the Soviets in places like Poland and Hungary, and certain percentages of influence would be granted to the British. Of course, Stalin was bemused at best and sort of dismissive of this note by Churchill, this little note written down. And he said to Churchill, well, you know, Churchill said basically, I don't think anyone should ever see this. And Stalin said, oh, you know, you keep it. Stalin already knew that he had the military muscle to enforce spheres of influence in Poland and Eastern Europe, irrespective of what the British or the Americans said. And Churchill, well, the place where Churchill believed that the British, or at least the Western allies, should have the most influence was Greece. And Greece is something that Stalin wasn't very interested in anyway. He didn't see controlling Greece as really a key part of his strategy for the meantime. This is interesting. I mean, routes into the Mediterranean, into the Dardanelles, had always been an imperial czarist Russian objective and goal. So why would Stalin not want to emulate this particularly? Well, possibly because Stalin saw the chief aim of his foreign policy as building defences against a resurgent Germany. His view, his mindset of Germany really was that kind of fascism had been essentially the attack dog of capitalist powers, that Hitler, for all his kind of racial rhetoric, was really the kind of the dupe of capitalist powers, and that those capitalist powers were now still clearly in place. They were still, you know, the Americans and the British were still a kind of a dominant capitalist force, and that it was entirely possible that they would put Germany back on its feet and send the attack dog back after Soviet communism before too long. And this is something that Stalin took very seriously indeed. So you can see why it is, looking at Greece, that Greece is seen as something of an irrelevance. Greece had, of course, been invaded by Mussolini in October 1940, and the resultant attempts to occupy Greece are fairly disastrous. The Greek partisans fight tenaciously. The Italian army is poorly equipped, poorly led, poorly motivated. And the Greek terrain is one of the most difficult terrains in the world to conquer. It's mountainous. There are deep forests and marshes and all these kinds of things that the Italians hadn't really thought of. If you read the brilliant Fascist Voices by Christopher Duggan, there's all sorts of first-hand accounts in there of the general sort of dying of any optimism the Italian soldiers had in the Duce and in fascism through the experience of trying to wage war in Greece. In 1941, the Germans turn up, Hitler sends 1,000 panzers to Greece in order to help Mussolini out of the mess he's in. Some historians argue that this perhaps delayed the timetable for Barbarossa, as the Greeks, as the Germans invade not only Greece but also Yugoslavia, and the result of this meant that the timetable for Barbarossa was done late, and therefore the Germans get bogged down in the winter and so on and so forth. This used to be orthodoxy, but it's coming increasingly in doubt whether really this had much of an influence on the timetable for Barbarossa at all. In 1943, following the capitulation of the Italian government and the decision to switch sides and overthrow Mussolini, the Germans take direct control of the Greek peninsula and islands. There's a particular scene in the book, don't watch the film, it has Nicolas Cage doing an embarrassing Italian accent, but Louis de Bernier's Captain Corelli's mandolin is an infamous moment where the Italians who are occupying the Greek islands are massacred by the Germans, because the Germans obviously now feel that these are a dubious and a disloyal and potentially treacherous former ally. And the Germans occupy Greece with an immense amount of brutality. the partisan guerrilla war that the Greeks had been waging against the Germans, German military discipline and German military law, in fact, is particularly harsh on non-uniform combatants, irregular soldiers, Franc-tireur, as they are known in the parlance of the German army. And the Hitler having signed the kind of the partisan decree in 1941, which gave carte blanche really to execute Soviet commissars, meant that there was a huge amount of violence against Greek partisans and their villagers in trying to put down the insurrection. Now, the bit where it becomes interesting, I think, is where we look at the different kinds of resistance in Greece. There were anti-German resistance groups of a range of different political persuasions, but obviously the ones that tend to be more successful, and you see this happening all across Europe, and more organised and more disciplined, are the communists. And the resistance groups in Greece, as you find in other places such as France, fought it out amongst one another, trying to establish a kind of an ideological dominance or orthodoxy that would then supplant Nazism when the Germans finally left. So you see the seeds really of a civil war emerging during the embers of World War II. Now again, our conventional way of looking at World War II is it is a titanic struggle between the Western Allies on one side and the Axis powers on the other. But as you look into all sorts of European and Asian countries, civil wars begin to emerge as a result of Nazi occupation. The experience of the Greeks was one of resistance and collaboration. On one hand, you have the Iam Elas communists, and on the other, you have militias who have been organised by the Nazis, by the Germans, in order to help police their own people. And so as a result, you have your own homegrown Greek fascism there in order to perhaps be the auxiliaries of the Nazis. And the dilemma that people like Churchill have is, well, who do you back? You have essentially Stalinists or fascists, and you've got to choose one side or the other. Churchill was a staunch friend of the King George II, the Greek King George II, and was determined to see him return. He had no desire to hand the country over to communism. And I think Churchill, perhaps after the Yalta Conference, had seen the writing on the wall, was well aware that there was almost nothing that could be done in order to keep the Soviets from controlling Eastern Europe. So perhaps Greece was one place where Churchill could salvage something, where perhaps he could demonstrate that he had drawn some kind of line in the sand against the encroaching threat of communism. Greece's interwar history had been one which had heavily featured right-wing repression under General Yiannis Metaxas, who had served under George II and in 1936 had declared martial law. He is credited by some as the man who saved Greece from the Italians, but he died months before the German invasion, died of natural causes, it must be stated. It was British agents of the Special Operations Executive who parachuted into Greece who managed to draw together the National Republican League, who were non-communist partisans, and the communists, and managed to build a kind of uneasy truce between them, but one that was quite effective in that they managed to carry out
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
A number of very important guerrilla raids, including a coup for the British, the destruction of a railway line at Gorgopotamus. And this destroyed a bridge for 4 months, which managed to close off a supply line from Germany to Rommel's Panzer Army in North Africa. It was one of the great espionage and sabotage triumphs of the war. However, for much of their time in Greece, British agents were at a loss as to how to deal with the rival groups of Greek partisans. They feuded amongst each other, and the British struggled really to find a kind of a lasting alliance to unite the various warring parties. The communists naturally mistrusted the British, and that whilst they wanted the help and assistance and equipment and kudos that an alliance with the British brought, they also were deeply suspect of their motives as kind of old-fashioned imperialists and enemies of the people in the eyes of the communists. Churchill, as mentioned, was insistent on the restoration of George II, and the various partisan groups were secretly flown to Cairo in 1943 in order to try to come to some kind of agreement. But it's the withdrawal of Germany from Greece in 1944 and later in 1945 that sees the whole situation really start to kind of rapidly evolve and change. The Greeks were aware that the Red Army was on the way. It had marched into Romania and Hungary in October 1944, and this is where the kind of the civil war commences. Greece was a victim of terrible brutalisation and famine in 1941, and this had had the effect of really kind of polarising much of the Greek population. It had driven many into the arms of the communists, not people that were instinctively readers of Marx, put it that way, but people who really believed that there was little alternative, that the communists offered the only chance, really, of any kind of meaningful future. The problem for the Communist Party was that Stalin had already, prior to his agreement with Churchill, which is why he was sort of so secretly bemused by Churchill and perhaps slightly laughing into his sleeve, he'd already sent a series of military advisers to Greece to tell them of what he called geopolitical realities. He said, in essence, Russia hasn't got, or the Soviet Union hasn't got any business in Greece, but the British wish to have business in Greece, and you must cooperate with them. The defeat of Nazism is the main thing. That's what will benefit the Soviet motherland the most. And so this is what I want you to do. In April 1944, the communists hold elections. They call them revolution elections, and this is essentially a power grab. They had hoped that the national leader, or nationalist leader really, George Papandreou, would act as a kind of a figurehead, and behind the scenes the communists could manipulate him some kind of titular head of a national government, similar to the kinds of popular front governments that Stalin would later try to create in places like Poland and Czechoslovakia, but were really kind of communist governments in all but name. Papandreou doesn't decide that he rather doesn't fancy that and becomes the head of the government in exile in Cairo. And the communists have a perfect opportunity to wage a kind of bloody repression stroke class war, because they can identify so many people as traitors, as people who have collaborated with the Nazis, whether or not that's really happened at all. The Germans had recruited men into their security battalions, so a kind of a paramilitary force. And these security battalions were not simply reluctant conscripts, but very often held the kinds of reactionary fascist views, and were particularly motivated by anti-communism, and were the ideal candidates for an anti-communist fight. But the security battalions also have to appeal to the British. They didn't want to present themselves as being the stooges of the Nazis. So they, you know, let some political prisoners go. They put out feelers to the British and present themselves as monarchists and patriots and anti-communists. And certainly people who had never had anything to do with the regime when that was in power. Days after the Germans finally evacuated Athens, the British turn up with a small force in comparative terms, but one which was there to restore order to, and by order, under Churchill's view, that meant the restoration of the monarchy, which is by and large not a popular option in Greece. The, you know, communist or non-communist, most people were unified by the idea that a different kind of government was what was necessary. Much of the problem here comes down to Churchill's miscalculations, that he believed that active intervention was necessary to keep Greece out of the Soviet sphere of influence, but there was very little chance of it ever being in the Soviet sphere of influence. Papandreou is returned by the British, and he begins to include some of the security battalion in his new government, and this is absolutely hated and despised. These people are loathed far more than the communists are. They are being responsible for all manner of crimes, and certainly those they have been identified as sort of stooges of the Nazis. And Churchill and his general, who is in charge of the Greek operation, General Scobie, operate really as kind of imperial administrators of Greece. The British soldiers on the streets, acting as a police force, were there to keep order, and there was every risk that they would be drawn into a civil war if the communists decided to fire upon them. And this indeed happens, which results in the British carrying out airstrikes against the Greeks, against the Greek communists. And the Greek communists then declare open war, not really on the British, but on the bourgeoisie of Athens, and began to take hostages from middle-class families and carry out executions. It's the British kind of rise to the communist bait, quite catastrophically. Churchill is persuaded by Harold Macmillan, then the minister for the Mediterranean area, to not return George II until there's really been some kind of national plebiscite or referendum as to whether the Greeks want a monarchy at all. And instead to appoint Archbishop Damaskinos as the regent for Greece until some kind of decision can be made. Churchill isn't happy about this, but now he's really starting to attract an awful lot of criticism, particularly from the Americans. And the Americans towards the end of the war really begin to tire of Churchill and tire of his kind of what they view as his quasi-imperial meddling. And really, they are particularly annoyed about Churchill seemingly unnecessary interfering in the Mediterranean. And they are suspicious that it's a way of steering the Americans into a further and wider conflict in the Mediterranean. It was claimed that Churchill was tearing up the Atlantic Charter, which had been decided between Churchill and Roosevelt in 1941, and had been agreed that there would be a principle of self-determination. This was based on the assumption that was prevalent in the American media and prevalent in American politics, that anyone who'd been fighting against the Nazis, i.e. the Greek communists, must be on some level some kind of freedom-loving patriot. And obviously this isn't always the case. Well, Churchill sails to Greece on the HMS Ajax, and Churchill and a number of his ministers, including Anthony Eden, actually drive into Athens the next day in a couple of armoured cars. This is on Christmas Eve 1944. And the reason why Churchill has visited Athens is because he believes he's the only man that can save Greece from communism. The British embassy is now at this point, because of Britain's decision to openly attack the communists, is under siege, and Churchill meets Damaskinos at the embassy, along with there are American and French and Soviet representatives there. The communists also attend the meeting, but very little is decided. And as the new year begins, the various partisan groups are forced to abandon Athens because they're forced to stand still by the British army. The Greek Civil War at this point would continue for another 4 years. The British finally abandon Greece in 1947, accepting that they are unable to continue financing this anti-communist initiative. And it's really the decision by the British to abandon Greece in 1947 that leads to Harry Truman enunciating the Truman Doctrine, which is America's acceptance, really, of Britain's world role at that point, or at least Britain's role as kind of anti-communist policeman. And as the British are bankrupted at the end of the war, abandon their bases and colonies, it becomes clear to the Americans that they will have to step up and fill that gap. So anyway, as I was saying, there's a number of very interesting lessons that kind of come from this period of time. Firstly, there is the issue of these civil wars that emerge at the end of the Second World War. And secondly, as the Second World War came to an end, there were new directions that Churchill was hoping to take British policy in, and by extension drag the Americans along as well. And Churchill's war logically didn't logically end in his mind with the defeat of Germany. The final culmination of Churchill's thinking was Operation Unthinkable, which was to be a planned attack on the Soviet Union in order to liberate Poland. And it was aptly titled because his generals and air marshals found it unthinkable and essentially dismissed it as absolute lunacy in 1945. But I'll try to do something on Operation Unthinkable at a later date, because not enough, I think, is written about that. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Exciting news. The next Explaining History study guide, Explaining International Relations, 1870 to 1914, is going to be available, I think, this week. If not this week, then definitely next. And we should have a couple new Explaining History titles coming out soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.